Mammy was unusually silent those 2 days. She watched Scarlett out of the corner of her eye and said nothing. When the second night had passed, Scarlett made up her mind to go to the police. Perhaps he had had an accident. Perhaps his horse had thrown him and he was lying helpless in some ditch. Perhaps... oh, horrible thought! Perhaps he was dead. The next morning, when she had finished her breakfast and was in her room putting on her bonnet, she heard swift feet on the stairs. As she sank to the bed in weak thankfulness, Rhett entered the room. He was freshly barbered, shaved, and massaged, and he was sober, but his eyes were bloodshot and his face puffy from drink. He waved an airy hand at her and said, "Oh, hello." How could a man say, "Oh, hello," after being gone without explanation for 2 days? How could he be so nonchalant with the memory of such a night as they had spent? He couldn't unless... The terrible thought leaped into her mind. Unless such nights were the usual thing to him. For a moment she couldn't speak. And all the pretty gestures and smiles she had thought to use upon him were forgotten. He didn't even come to her to give her his usual offhand kiss, but stood looking at her, with a grin, a smoking cigar in his hand. Where have you been?
Don't tell me you don't know. I thought surely the whole town knew by now. Perhaps they all do, except you. You know the old adage, the wife is always the last one to find out.
What do you mean?
I thought that after the police called at Bell's night before last.
Bell's? That woman? You have been with...
Of course. Where else would I be? I hope you haven't worried about me.
You went from me to... Oh!
Come, come, Scarlett. Don't play the deceived wife. You must have known about Belle long ago.
You went to her from me after...
Oh, that.
He made a careless gesture.
I will forget my manners. My apologies for my conduct at our last meeting. I was very drunk, as you doubtless know, and quite swept off my feet by your charms. Need I enumerate them?
Suddenly she wanted to cry, to lie down on the bed and sob endlessly. He hadn't changed. Nothing had changed. And she had been a fool, a stupid, conceited, silly fool, thinking he loved her. It had all been one of his repulsive, drunken jests. He had taken her and used her when he was drunk, just as he would use any woman in Belle's house. And now he was back, insulting, sardonic, out of reach. She swallowed her tears and rallied. He must never, never know what she had thought. How he would laugh if he knew. Well, he'd never know. She looked up quickly at him and caught that old, puzzling, watchful glint in his eyes. Keen, eager, as though he hung on her next words, hoping they would be... What was he hoping? That she'd make a fool out of herself and bawl and give him something to laugh about? Not she. Her slanting brows rushed together in a cold frown. I had naturally suspected what your relations with that creature were.
Only suspected. Why didn't you ask me and satisfy your curiosity? I'd have told you. I've been living with her ever since the day you and Ashley Wilkes decided that we should have separate bedrooms.
You have the gall to stand there and boast to me, your wife, that...
Oh, spare me your moral indignation. You never gave a damn what I did, as long as I paid the bills. And you know I've been no angel recently. And as for you being my wife... You haven't been much of a wife since Bonnie came, have you? You've been a poor investment, Scarlett. Belle's been a better one.
Investment? You mean you gave her...
Set her up in business is the correct term, I believe. Belle's a smart woman. I wanted to see her get ahead, and all she needed was money to start a house of her own. You ought to know what miracles a woman can perform when she has a bit of cash. Look at yourself.
You compare me...
Well, you are both hard-headed businesswomen and both successful. Belle's got the edge on you, of course, because she's a kind-hearted, good-natured soul.
Will you get out of this room?
He lounged toward the door, one eyebrow raised quizzically.
How could he insult her so? She thought in rage and pain. He was going out of his way to hurt and humiliate her. And she writhed as she thought how she had longed for his homecoming, while all the time he was drunk and brawling with police in a bawdy house.
Get out of this room and don't ever come back in it. I told you that once before, and you weren't enough of a gentleman to understand. Hereafter, I will lock my door.
Don't bother.
I will lock it. After the way you acted the other night, so drunk, so disgusting.
Come now, darling. Not disgusting, surely.
Get out.
Don't worry. I'm going. And I promise I'll never bother you again. That's final. And I just thought I'd tell you that if my infamous conduct was too much for you to bear, I'll let you have a divorce. Just give me Bonnie and I won't contest it.
I would not think of disgracing the family with a divorce.
You'd disgrace it quick enough if Miss Melly was dead, wouldn't you? It makes my head spin to think how quickly you'd divorce me.
Will you go?
Yes, I'm going. That's what I came home to tell you. I'm going to Charleston and New Orleans and... Oh, well, a very extended trip. I'm leaving today.
Oh!
And I'm taking Bonnie with me. Get that foolish Prissy to pack her little duds. I'll take Prissy, too.
You'll never take my child out of this house.
My child, too, Mrs. Butler. Surely you do not mind me taking her to Charleston to see her grandmother.
Her grandmother, my foot! You think I'll let you take that baby out of here when you'll be drunk every night and most likely taking it to houses like that Bell's?
He threw down the cigar violently and it smoked acridly on the carpet, the smell of scorching wool rising to their nostrils. In an instant, he was across the floor and by her side, his face black with fury. If you were a man, I would break your neck for that. As it is, all I can say is for you to shut your goddamn mouth. Do you think I don't love Bonnie? That I would take her where... My daughter? Good God, you fool! And as for you, giving yourself pious airs about your motherhood, why, a cat's a better mother than you. What have you ever done for the children? Wade and Ella are frightened to death of you, and if it wasn't for Melanie Wilkes, they'd never know what love and affection are. But Bonnie, my Bonnie, do you think I can't take better care of her than you? Do you think I'll ever let you bully her and break her spirit as you've broken Wade's and Ella's? Hell no. Have her packed up and ready for me in an hour, or I warn you what happened the other night will be mild beside what will happen. I've always thought a good lashing with a buggy whip would benefit you immensely. He turned on his heel before she could speak and went out of the room on swift feet. She heard him cross the floor of the hall to the children's playroom and open the door. There was a glad, quick treble of childish voices, and she heard Bonnie's tones rise over Ella's.
"Daddy, where you been?"
"Hunting for a rabbit skin to wrap my little Bonnie in. Give your best sweetheart a kiss, Bonnie. And you too, Ella."
Chapter 55.
"Darling, I don't want any explanation from you, and I won't listen to one," said Melanie firmly, as she gently laid a small hand across Scarlett's tortured lips and stilled her words. "You insult yourself and Ashley and me by even thinking there could be need of explanations between us. Why, we three have been like soldiers fighting the world together for so many years that I'm ashamed of you for thinking idle gossip could come between us. Do you think I'd believe that you and my Ashley? Why, the idea! Don't you realize I know you better than anyone in the world knows you? Do you think I've forgotten all the wonderful, unselfish things you've done for Ashley and Beau and me? Everything from saving my life to keeping us from starving? Do you think I could remember you walking in a furrow behind that Yankee's horse, almost barefooted, and with your hands blistered,
just so the baby and I could have something to eat, and then believe such dreadful things about you?
I don't want to hear a word out of you, Scarlett O'Hara. Not a word.
But...
Scarlett fumbled and stopped. Rhett had left town the hour before with Bonnie and Prissy, and desolation was added to Scarlett's shame and anger. The additional burden of her guilt with Ashley and Melanie's defense was more than she could bear. Had Melanie believed India and Archie, caught her at the reception, or even greeted her frigidly, she could have held her head high and fought back with every weapon in her armory. But now, with the memory of Melanie standing between her and social ruin, standing like a thin, shining blade with trust and a fighting light in her eyes, there seemed nothing honest to do but confess. Yes, blurt out everything from that far-off beginning on the sunny porch at Terra. She was driven by a conscience which, though long suppressed, could still rise up. An active Catholic conscience. Confess your sins and do penance for them in sorrow and contrition. Ellen had told her 100 times. And in this crisis, Ellen's religious training came back and gripped her. She would confess, yes, everything, every look and word, those few caresses. And then God would ease her pain and give her peace. And for her penance, there would be the dreadful sight of Melanie's face changing from fond love and trust to incredulous horror and repulsion. Oh, that was too hard a penance, she thought in anguish. To have to live out her life remembering Melanie's face, knowing that Melanie knew all the pettiness, the meanness, the two-faced disloyalty and the hypocrisy that were in her. Once, the thought of flinging the truth tauntingly in Melanie's face and seeing the collapse of her fool's paradise had been an intoxicating one, a gesture worth everything she might lose thereby. But now, all that had changed overnight. And there was nothing she desired less. Why this should be, she didn't know. There was too great a tumult of conflicting ideas in her mind for her to sort them out. She only knew that as she had once desired to keep her mother thinking her modest, kind, pure of heart, so she now passionately desired to keep Melanie's high opinion. She only knew that she didn't care what the world thought of her, or what Ashley or Rhett thought of her. But Melanie must not think her other than she had always thought her. She dreaded to tell Melanie the truth, but one of her rare honest instincts arose, an instinct that would not let her masquerade in false colors before the woman who had fought her battles for her. So she hurried to Melanie that morning, as soon as Rhett and Bonnie had left the house. But at her first tumbled-out words, "Melly, I must explain about the other day," Melanie had imperiously stopped her. Scarlett, looking shamefaced into the dark eyes that were flashing with love and anger, knew with a sinking heart that the peace and calm following confession could never be hers. Melanie had forever cut off that line of action by her first words. With one of the few adult emotions Scarlett had ever had, she realized that to unburden her own tortured heart would be the purest selfishness. She would be ridding herself of her burden and laying it on the heart of an innocent and trusting person. She owed Melanie a debt for her championship, and that debt could only be paid with silence. What cruel payment it would be to wreck Melanie's life with the unwelcome knowledge that her husband was unfaithful to her, and her beloved friend a party to it. "I can't tell her," she thought miserably. "Never. Not even if my conscience kills me." She remembered, irrelevantly, Rhett's drunken remark. "She can't conceive of dishonor in anyone she loves. Let that be your cross." Yes, it would be her cross, until she died, to keep this torment silent within her, to wear the hair shirt of shame, to feel it chafing her at every tender look and gesture. Melanie would make throughout the years.
To subdue forever the impulse to cry, "Don't be so kind, don't fight for me, I'm not worth it."
"If you only weren't such a fool, such a sweet, trusting, simple-minded fool, it wouldn't be so hard," she thought desperately. "I've toted lots of weary loads, but this is going to be the heaviest and most galling load I've ever toted." Melanie sat facing her in a low chair, her feet firmly planted on an ottoman so high that her knees stuck up like a child's, a posture she would never have assumed had not rage possessed her to the point of forgetting proprieties. She held a line of tatting in her hands, and she was driving the shining needle back and forth as furiously as though handling a rapier in a duel. Had Scarlet been possessed of such an anger, she would have been stamping both feet and roaring like Gerald in his finest days, calling on God to witness the accursed duplicity and knavishness of mankind, and uttering blood-curdling threats of retaliation. But only by the flashing needle and the delicate brows drawn down toward her nose did Melanie indicate that she was inwardly seething. Her voice was cool, and her words more close-clipped than usual. But the forceful words she uttered were foreign to Melanie, who seldom voiced an opinion at all, and never an unkind word. Scarlet realized suddenly that the Wilkeses and the Hamiltons were capable of furies equal to and surpassing those of the O'Haras. "I've gotten mighty tired of hearing people criticize you, darling," Melanie said. "And this is the last straw, and I'm going to do something about it. All this has happened because people are jealous of you, because you are so smart and successful. You've succeeded where lots of men, even, have failed. Now don't be vexed with me, dear, for saying that. I don't mean you've ever been unwomanly or unsexed yourself, as lots of folks have said, because you haven't. People just don't understand you. And people can't bear for women to be smart. But your smartness and your success don't give people the right to say that you and Ashley, stars above..." The soft vehemence of this last ejaculation would have been, upon a man's lips, profanity of no uncertain meaning. Scarlet stared at her, alarmed by so unprecedented an outburst. "And for them to come to me with their filthy lies they concocted. Archie, India, Mrs. Elsing, how did they dare? Of course, Mrs. Elsing didn't come here. No, indeed, she didn't have the courage. But she's always hated you, darling, because you were more popular than Fanny. And she was so incensed at your demoting Hugh from the management of the mill. But you were quite right in demoting him. He's just a piddling do-less, good-for-nothing." Swiftly Melanie dismissed the playmate of her childhood and the beau of her teen years. "I blame myself about Archie. I shouldn't have given the old scoundrel shelter. Everyone told me so, but I wouldn't listen. He didn't like you, dear, because of the convicts. But who is he to criticize you? A murderer. And the murderer of a woman, too. And after all I've done for him, he comes to me and tells me... I shouldn't have been a bit sorry if Ashley had shot him. Well, I packed him off with a large flea in his ear, I can tell you. And he's left town. And as for India, the vile thing, darling... I couldn't help noticing from the first time I saw you two together that she was jealous of you and hated you, because you were so much prettier and had so many beaux. And she hated you especially about Stuart Tarleton. And she's brooded about Stuart so much that... Well, I hate to say it about Ashley's sister, but I think her mind has broken with thinking so much. There's no other explanation for her action. I told her never to put foot in this house again, and that if I heard her breathe so vile an insinuation, I would call her a liar in public." Melanie stopped speaking, and abruptly the anger left her face, and sorrow swamped it. Melanie had all that passionate clan loyalty peculiar to Georgians, and the thought of a family quarrel tore her heart. She faltered for a moment, but Scarlet was dearest. Scarlet came first in her heart, and she went on loyally. "She's always been jealous because I loved you best, dear. She'll never come in this house again, and I'll never put foot under any roof that receives her. Ashley agrees with me. But it's just about broken his heart that his own sister should tell such a..." At the mention of Ashley's name, Scarlett's overwrought nerves gave way and she burst into tears. Would she never stop stabbing him to the heart? Her only thought had been to make him happy and safe, but at every turn she seemed to hurt him. She had wrecked his life, broken his pride and self-respect, shattered that inner peace, that calm based on integrity. And now she had alienated him from the sister he loved so dearly. To save her own reputation and his wife's happiness, India had to be sacrificed, forced into the light of a lying, half-crazed, jealous old maid. India, who was absolutely justified in every suspicion she had ever harbored and every accusing word she had uttered. Whenever Ashley looked into India's eyes, he would see the truth shining there, truth and reproach and the cold contempt of which the Wilkes were masters. Knowing how Ashley valued honor above his life, Scarlett knew he must be writhing. He, like Scarlett, was forced to shelter behind Melanie's skirts. While Scarlett realized the necessity for this and knew that the blame for his false position lay mostly at her own door, still. Woman-like, she would have respected Ashley more had he shot Archie and admitted everything to Melanie and the world. She knew she was being unfair, but she was too miserable to care for such fine points. Some of Rhett's taunting words of contempt came back to her, and she wondered if indeed Ashley had played the manly part in this mess. And for the first time, some of the bright glow which had enveloped him since the first day she fell in love with him began to fade imperceptibly. The tarnish of shame and guilt that enveloped her spread to him as well. Resolutely she tried to fight off this thought, but it only made her cry harder. Don't, cried Melanie, dropping her tatting and flinging herself onto the sofa and drawing Scarlett's head down onto her shoulder. I shouldn't have talked about it all and distressed you so. I know how dreadfully you must feel, and we'll never mention it again. No, not to each other or to anybody. It'll be as though it never happened, but, she added with quiet venom, I'm going to show India and Mrs. Elsing what's what. They needn't think they can spread lies about my husband and my sister-in-law. I'm going to fix it so neither of them can hold up their heads in Atlanta. And anybody who believes them or receives them is my enemy. Scarlett, looking sorrowfully down the long vista of years to come, knew that she was the cause of a feud that would split the town and the family for generations. Melanie was as good as her word. She never again mentioned the subject to Scarlett or to Ashley. Nor, for that matter, would she discuss it with anyone. She maintained an air of cool indifference that could speedily change to icy formality if anyone even dared hint about the matter. During the weeks that followed her surprise party, while Rhett was mysteriously absent and the town in a frenzied state of gossip, excitement, and partisanship, she gave no quarter to Scarlett's detractors, whether they were her old friends or her blood kin. She did not speak, she acted. She stuck by Scarlett's side like a cockle-burr. She made Scarlett go to the store in the lumber yard, as usual, every morning, and she went with her. She insisted that Scarlett go driving in the afternoons. Little though Scarlett wished to expose herself to the eager, curious gaze of her fellow townspeople. And Melanie sat in the carriage beside her. Melanie took her calling with her on formal afternoons, gently forcing her into parlors in which Scarlett had not sat for more than 2 years. And Melanie, with a fierce, "Love me, love my dog," look on her face, made converse with astounded hostesses. She made Scarlett arrive early on these afternoons and remain until the last callers had gone, thereby depriving the ladies of the opportunity for enjoyable group discussion and speculation, a matter which caused some mild indignation. These calls were an especial torment to Scarlett, but she dared not refuse to go with Melanie. She hated to sit amid crowds of women who were secretly wondering if she had been actually taken in adultery. She hated the knowledge that these women would not have spoken to her, had it not been that they loved Melanie, and didn't want to lose her friendship. But Scarlet knew that, having once received her, they could not cut her thereafter. It was characteristic of the regard in which Scarlet was held that few people based their defense or their criticism of her on her personal integrity.
"I wouldn't put much beyond her,"
was the universal attitude. Scarlet had too many enemies to have many champions now. Her words and her actions rankled in too many hearts for many people to care whether this scandal hurt her or not. But everyone cared violently about hurting Melanie or India, and the storm revolved around them rather than Scarlet, centering upon the one question, did India lie? Those who espoused Melanie's side pointed triumphantly to the fact that Melanie was constantly with Scarlet these days. Would a woman of Melanie's high principles champion the cause of a guilty woman, especially a woman guilty with her own husband? No, indeed. India was just a cracked old maid who hated Scarlet and lied about her, and induced Archie and Mrs. Elsing to believe her lies. But questioned India's adherence. If Scarlet isn't guilty, where is Captain Butler? Why isn't he here at his wife's side, lending her the strength of his countenance? That was an unanswerable question. And as the weeks went by, and the rumor spread that Scarlet was pregnant, the pro-India group nodded with satisfaction. It couldn't be Captain Butler's baby, they said. For too long the fact of their estrangement had been public property. For too long the town had been scandalized by the separate bedrooms. So the gossip ran, tearing the town apart, tearing apart, too, the close-knit clan of Hamiltons, Wilkes, Burrs, Whitmans, and Winfields. Everyone in the family connection was forced to take sides. There was no neutral ground. Melanie, with cool dignity, and India with acid bitterness, saw to that. But no matter which side the relatives took, they all were resentful that Scarlet should have been the cause of the family breach. None of them thought her worth it. And no matter which side they took, the relatives heartily deplored the fact that India had taken it upon herself to wash the family dirty linen so publicly and involve Ashley in so degrading a scandal. But now that she had spoken, many rushed to her defense and took her side against Scarlet, even as others, loving Melanie, stood by her and Scarlet. Half of Atlanta was kin to, or claimed kin with, Melanie and India. The ramifications of cousins, double cousins, cousins-in-law, and kissing cousins were so intricate and involved that no one but a born Georgian could ever unravel them. They had always been a clannish tribe, presenting an unbroken phalanx of overlapping shields to the world in time of stress, no matter what their private opinions of the conduct of individual kinsmen might be. With the exception of the guerrilla warfare carried on by Aunt Pity against Uncle Henry, which had been a matter for hilarious laughter within the family for years, there had never been an open breach in the pleasant relations. They were gentle, quiet-spoken, reserved people, and not given to even the amiable bickering that characterized most Atlanta families. But now they were split in twain, and the town was privileged to witness cousins of the fifth and sixth degree taking sides in the most shattering scandal Atlanta had ever seen. This worked great hardship and strained the tact and forbearance of the unrelated half of the town. For the India-Melanie feud made a rupture in practically every social organization. The Thalians, the sewing circle for the widows and orphans of the Confederacy. The Association for the Beautification of the Graves of Our Glorious Dead. The Saturday Night Musical Circle. The Ladies' Evening Cotillion Society. The Young Men's Library were all involved. So were four churches with their ladies' aid and missionary societies. Great care had to be taken to avoid putting members of warring factions on the same committees.
On their regular afternoons at home, Atlanta matrons were in anguish from 4 to 6 o'clock for fear Melanie and Scarlett would call at the same time India and her loyal kin were in their parlors. Of all the family, poor Aunt Pitty suffered the most. Pitty, who desired nothing except to live comfortably amid the love of her relatives, would have been very pleased in this matter, to run with the hares and hunt with the hounds. But neither the hares nor the hounds would permit this. India lived with Aunt Pitty, and if Pitty sided with Melanie, as she wished to do, India would leave. And if India left her, what would poor Pitty do then? She couldn't live alone. She would have to get a stranger to live with her, or she would have to close up her house and go and live with Scarlett. Aunt Pitty felt vaguely that Captain Butler wouldn't care for this. Or she would have to go and live with Melanie and sleep in the little cubbyhole that was Beau's nursery. Pitty was not overly fond of India, for India intimidated her with her dry, stiff-necked ways and her passionate convictions. But she made it possible for Pitty to keep her own comfortable establishment, and Pitty was always swayed more by considerations of personal comfort than by moral issues. And so, India remained. But her presence in the house made Aunt Pitty a storm center, for both Scarlett and Melanie took that to mean that she sided with India. Scarlett curtly refused to contribute more money to Pitty's establishment, as long as India was under the same roof. Ashley sent India money every week, and every week India proudly and silently returned it, much to the old lady's alarm and regret. Finances at the Red Brick House would have been in a deplorable state, but for Uncle Henry's intervention, and it humiliated Pitty to take money from him. Pitty loved Melanie better than anyone in the world, except herself, and now Melanie acted like a cool, polite stranger. Though she practically lived in Pitty's backyard, she never once came through the hedge, and she used to run in and out a dozen times a day. Pitty called on her and wept and protested her love and devotion, but Melanie always refused to discuss matters and never returned the calls. Pitty knew very well what she owed Scarlett, almost her very existence. Certainly in those black days after the war, when Pitty was faced with the alternative of Brother Henry or starvation, Scarlett had kept her home for her, fed her, clothed her, and enabled her to hold up her head in Atlanta society. And since Scarlett had married and moved into her own home, she had been generosity itself. And that frightening, fascinating Captain Butler, frequently after he called with Scarlett, Pitty found brand new purses stuffed with bills on her console table, or lace handkerchiefs knotted about gold pieces which had been slyly slipped into her sewing box. Rhett always vowed he knew nothing about them and accused her, in a very unrefined way, of having a secret admirer, usually the bewhiskered Grandpa Merriweather. Yes, Pitty owed love to Melanie, security to Scarlett. And what did she owe India? Nothing, except that India's presence kept her from having to break up her pleasant life and make decisions for herself. It was almost distressing, and too vulgar, and Pitty, who had never made a decision for herself in her whole life, simply let matters go on as they were, and as a result spent much time in uncomforted tears. In the end, some people believed wholeheartedly in Scarlett's innocence, not because of her own personal virtue, but because Melanie believed in it. Some had mental reservations, but they were courteous to Scarlett, and called on her because they loved Melanie, and wished to keep her love. India's adherents bowed coldly, and some few cut her openly. These last were embarrassing, infuriating. But Scarlett realized that, except for Melanie's championship and her quick action, the face of the whole town would have been set against her. And she would have been an outcast. Chapter 56. Rhett was gone for 3 months,
and during that time Scarlet had no word from him. She didn't know where he was or how long he would be gone. Indeed, she had no idea if he would ever return. During this time, she went about her business with her head high and her heart sick. She didn't feel well physically, but forced by Melanie, she went to the store every day and tried to keep up a superficial interest in the mills. But the store palled on her for the first time, and although the business was treble what it had been the year before, and the money rolling in, she could take no interest in it, and was sharp and cross with the clerks. Johnny Gallagher's mill was thriving and the lumber yard selling all his supply easily, but nothing Johnny did or said pleased her. Johnny, as Irish as she, finally erupted into rage at her naggings and threatened to quit. After a long tirade which ended with, "And the back of both me hands to you, ma'am, and the curse of Cromwell on you." She had to appease him with the most abject of apologies. She never went to Ashley's mill, nor did she go to the lumberyard office when she thought he would be there. She knew he was avoiding her, knew that her constant presence in his house, at Melanie's inescapable invitations, was a torment to him. They never spoke alone, and she was desperate to question him. She wanted to know whether he now hated her, and exactly what he had told Melanie. But he held her at arm's length, and silently pleaded with her not to speak. The sight of his face, old, haggard with remorse, added to her load, and the fact that his mill lost money every week was an extra irritant which she could not voice. His helplessness in the face of the present situation irked her. She didn't know what he could do to better matters, but she felt that he should do something. Rhett would have done something. Rhett always did something, even if it was the wrong thing, and she unwillingly respected him for it. Now that her first rage at Rhett and his insults had passed, she began to miss him, and she missed him more and more as days went by without news of him. Out of the welter of rapture and anger and heartbreak and hurt pride that he had left, depression emerged to sit upon her shoulder like a carrion crow. She missed him, missed his light, flippant touch in anecdotes that made her shout with laughter, his sardonic grin that reduced troubles to their proper proportions, missed even his jeers that stung her to angry retort. Most of all, she missed having him to tell things to. Rhett was so satisfactory in that respect. She could recount shamelessly and with pride how she had skinned people out of their eye teeth, and he would applaud. And if she even mentioned such things to other people, they were shocked. She was lonely without him and Bonnie. She missed the child more than she had thought possible. Remembering the last harsh words Rhett had hurled at her about Wade and Ella, she tried to fill in some of her empty hours with them, but it was no use. Rhett's words and the children's reactions opened her eyes to a startling, a galling truth. During the babyhood of each child, she had been too busy, too worried with money matters, too sharp and easily vexed, to win their confidence or affection. And now, it was either too late, or she didn't have the patience or the wisdom to penetrate their small, secretive hearts. Ella. It annoyed Scarlet to realize that Ella was a silly child, but she undoubtedly was. She couldn't keep her little mind on one subject any longer than a bird could stay on one twig. And even when Scarlet tried to tell her stories, Ella went off at childish tangents, interrupting with questions about matters that had nothing to do with the story, and forgetting what she had asked long before Scarlet could get the explanation out of her mouth. And as for Wade, perhaps Rhett was right. Perhaps he was afraid of her. That was odd. And it hurt her. Why should her own boy, her only boy, be afraid of her? When she tried to draw him out and talk, he looked at her with Charles's soft brown eyes and squirmed and twisted his feet in embarrassment. But with Melanie, he bubbled over with talk and brought from his pocket everything from fishing worms to old strings to show her. Melanie had a way with brats. There was no getting around it. Her own little Beau was the best-behaved and most lovable child in Atlanta. Scarlett got on better with him than she did with her own son, because little Beau had no self-consciousness where grown people were concerned, and climbed on her knee, uninvited, whenever he saw her. What a beautiful blonde boy he was, just like Ashley. Now, if only Wade were like Beau. Of course, the reason Melanie could do so much with him was that she had only one child, and she hadn't had to worry and work as Scarlett had. At least Scarlett tried to excuse herself that way, but honesty forced her to admit that Melanie loved children and would have welcomed a dozen. And the over-brimming affection she had was poured out on Wade and the neighbors' broods. Scarlett would never forget the shock of the day she drove by Melanie's house to pick up Wade, and heard as she came up the front walk the sound of her son's voice raised in a very fair imitation of the rebel yell. Wade, who was always as still as a mouse at home. And manfully seconding Wade's yell was the shrill piping of Beau. When she had walked into the sitting room, she had found the two charging at the sofa with wooden swords. They had hushed abashed as she entered, and Melanie had arisen, laughing and clutching at hairpins and flying curls, from where she was crouching behind the sofa. "It's Gettysburg," she explained. "And I'm the Yankees, and I've certainly gotten the worst of it. This is General Lee," pointing to Beau, "and this is General Pickett," putting an arm around Wade's shoulder. "Yes." Melanie had a way with children that Scarlett could never fathom. "At least," she thought, "Bonnie loves me and likes to play with me." But honesty forced her to admit that Bonnie infinitely preferred Rhett to her. And perhaps she would never see Bonnie again. For all she knew, Rhett might be in Persia or Egypt and intending to stay there forever. When Dr. Meade told her she was pregnant, she was astounded. For she had been expecting a diagnosis of biliousness and overwrought nerves. Then her mind fled back to that wild night, and her face went crimson at the memory. So a child was coming from those moments of high rapture, even if the memory of the rapture was dimmed by what followed. And for the first time she was glad that she was going to have a child, if it were only a boy, a fine boy, not a spiritless little creature like Wade. How she would care for him. Now that she had the leisure to devote to a baby and the money to smooth his path, how happy she would be. She had an impulse to write to Rhett in care of his mother in Charleston and tell him. Good heavens, he must come home now. Suppose he stayed away till after the baby was born. She could never explain that. But if she wrote him, he'd think she wanted him to come home and he would be amused. And he mustn't ever think she wanted him or needed him. She was very glad she had stifled this impulse when her first news of Rhett came in a letter from Aunt Pauline in Charleston, where it seemed Rhett was visiting his mother. What a relief to know he was still in the United States, even if Aunt Pauline's letter was infuriating. Rhett had brought Bonnie to see her and Aunt Eulalie, and the letter was full of praise. "Such a little beauty! When she grows up, she will certainly be a belle. But I suppose you know that any man who courts her will have a tussle with Captain Butler, for I never saw such a devoted father. Now, my dear, I wish to confess something. Until I met Captain Butler, I felt that your marriage with him had been a dreadful misalliance, for, of course, no one in Charleston hears anything good about him, and everyone is so sorry for his family. In fact, Eulalie and I were uncertain as to whether or not we should receive him. But after all, the dear child is our great niece. When he came, we were pleasantly surprised, most pleasantly, and realized how unchristian it is to credit idle gossip. For he is most charming. Quite handsome, too, we thought. And so very grave and courteous. And so devoted to you and the child. And now, my dear, I must write you of something that has come to our ears. Something Eulalie and I were loath to believe at first. We had heard, of course, that you sometimes did about at the store that Mr. Kennedy had left you. We had heard rumors, but of course we denied them. We realized that in those first dreadful days after the war, it was perhaps necessary, conditions being what they were. But there is no necessity now for such conduct on your part. As I know, Captain Butler is in quite comfortable circumstances, and is, moreover, fully capable of managing for you any business and property you may own. We had to know the truth of these rumors, and were forced to ask Captain Butler point-blank questions, which was most distressing to all of us. With reluctance, he told us that you spent your mornings at the store and would permit no one else to do the bookkeeping. He also admitted that you had some interest in a mill, or mills. We did not press him on this, being most upset at this information, which was news to us. That necessitated your riding about alone, or attended by a ruffian who, Captain Butler assures us, is a murderer. We could see how this wrung his heart, and think he must be a most indulgent, in fact, a far too indulgent husband. Scarlet, this must stop. Your mother is not here to command you, and I must do it in her place. Think how your little children will feel when they grow older and realize that you were in trade. How mortified they will be to know that you exposed yourself to the insults of rude men and the dangers of careless gossip in attending to mills. Such unwomanly. Scarlet flung down the letter unfinished with an oath. She could just see Aunt Pauline and Aunt Eulalie sitting in judgment on her in the crumbling house on the Battery, with little between them and starvation except what she, Scarlet, sent them every month. Unwomanly. By God, if she hadn't been unwomanly, Aunt Pauline and Aunt Eulalie probably wouldn't have a roof over their heads this very moment. And damn Rhett for telling them about the store and the bookkeeping and the mills. Reluctant was he. She knew very well the joy he took in palming himself off on the old ladies as grave, courteous and charming, the devoted husband and father. How he must have loved harrowing them with descriptions of her activities with the store, the mills, the saloon. What a devil he was! Why did such perverse things give him such pleasure? But soon, even this rage passed into apathy. So much of the keen zest had gone out of life recently. If only she could recapture the thrill and the glow of Ashley. If only Rhett would come home and make her laugh. They were home again, without warning. The first intimation of their return was the sound of luggage being thumped on the front hall floor, and Bonnie's voice crying, "Mother!" Scarlet hurried from her room to the top of the stairs and saw her daughter stretching her short, plump legs in an effort to climb the steps. A resigned, striped kitten was clutched to her breast. "Grandma gave him to me," she cried excitedly, holding the kitten out by the scruff. Scarlet swept her up into her arms and kissed her, thankful that the child's presence spared her her first meeting alone with Rhett. Looking over Bonnie's head, she saw him in the hall below, paying the cab driver. He looked up, saw her, and swept off his hat in a wide gesture, bowing as he did. When she met his dark eyes, her heart leaped. No matter what he was, no matter what he had done, he was home, and she was glad. "Where's Mammy?" asked Bonnie, wriggling in Scarlet's grasp, and she reluctantly set the child on her feet. It was going to be more difficult than she anticipated, greeting Rhett with just the proper degree of casualness, and as for telling him about the new baby. She looked at his face as he came up the steps, that dark, nonchalant face so impervious, so blank. No, she'd wait to tell him. She couldn't tell him right away, and yet such tidings as these belonged first to a husband, for a husband was always happy to hear them. But she didn't think he would be happy about it. She stood on the landing, leaning against the banisters and wondering if he would kiss her. But he did not. He only said, "You are looking pale, Mrs. Butler.
Is there a rouge shortage?
No word of missing her, even if he didn't mean it. And he might have at least kissed her in front of Mammy, who, after bobbing a curtsy, was leading Bonnie away down the hall to the nursery. He stood beside her on the landing, his eyes appraising her carelessly.
"Can this wanness mean that you've been missing me?"
he questioned, and though his lips smiled, his eyes did not. So that was going to be his attitude. He was going to be as hateful as ever. Suddenly the child she was carrying became a nauseating burden instead of something she had gladly carried. And this man before her, standing carelessly with his wide Panama hat upon his hip, her bitterest foe, the cause of all her troubles. There was venom in her eyes as she answered, venom that was too unmistakable to be missed. And the smile went from his face. "If I'm pale, it's your fault, and it's not because I've missed you, you conceited thing. It's because—" Oh. She hadn't intended to tell him like this, but the hot words rushed to her lips, and she flung them at him, careless of the servants who might hear. "It's because I'm going to have a baby." He sucked in his breath suddenly, and his eyes went rapidly over her. He took a quick step toward her, as though to put a hand on her arm, but she twisted away from him, and before the hate in her eyes, his face hardened.
"Indeed," he said coolly. "Well, who's the happy father? Ashley?"
She clutched the newel post until the ears of the carved lion dug with sudden pain into her palm. Even she, who knew him so well, had not anticipated this insult. Of course he was joking, but there were some jokes too monstrous to be borne. She wanted to rake her sharp nails across his eyes and blot out that queer light in them. "Damn you," she began, her voice shaking with sick rage. You know it's yours. And I don't want it any more than you do. No, no woman would want the child of a cad like you. I wish... Oh, God, I wish it was anybody's baby but yours." She saw his swarthy face change suddenly, anger and something she couldn't analyze making it twitch as though stung. "There," she thought in a hot rage of pleasure. "There, I've hurt him now." But the old impassive mask was back across his face, and he stroked one side of his mustache. "Cheer up," he said, turning from her and starting up the stairs. "Maybe you'll have a miscarriage." For a dizzy moment she thought what childbearing meant. The nausea that tore her, the tedious waiting, the thickening of her figure, the hours of pain. Things no man could ever realize. And he dared to joke. She would claw him. Nothing but the sight of blood upon his face would ease this pain in her heart. She lunged for him, swift as a cat. But with a light startled movement, he sidestepped, throwing up his arm to ward her off. She was standing on the edge of the freshly waxed top step, and as her arm, with the whole weight of her body behind it, struck his outthrust arm, she lost her balance. She made a wild clutch for the newel post and missed it. She went down the stairs backwards, feeling a sickening dart of pain in her ribs as she landed. And too dazed to catch herself, she rolled over and over to the bottom of the flight. It was the first time Scarlett had ever been ill, except when she had her babies. And somehow those times didn't count. She hadn't been forlorn and frightened then, as she was now, weak and pain-racked and bewildered. She knew she was sicker than they dared tell her, feebly realized that she might die. The broken ribs stabbed when she breathed, her bruised face and head ached, and her whole body was given over to demons who plucked at her with hot pincers and sawed on her with dull knives, and left her, for short intervals, so drained of strength that she couldn't regain grip on herself before they returned. No, childbirth had not been like this.
She had been able to eat hearty meals 2 hours after Wade and Ella and Bonnie had been born. But now the thought of anything but cool water brought on feeble nausea. How easy it was to have a child, and how painful not to have one. Strange. What a pang it had been, even in her pain, to know that she wouldn't have this child. Stranger still that it should have been the first child she really wanted. She tried to think why she wanted it, but her mind was too tired. Her mind was too tired to think of anything except fear of death. Death was in the room, and she had no strength to confront it, to fight it back, and she was frightened. She wanted someone strong to stand by her and hold her hand and fight off death until enough strength came back for her to do her own fighting. Rage had been swallowed up in pain, and she wanted Rhett. But he wasn't there. And she couldn't bring herself to ask for him. Her last memory of him was how he looked as he picked her up in the dark hall at the bottom of the steps, his face white and wiped clean of all save hideous fear, his voice hoarsely calling for Mammy. And then there was a faint memory of being carried upstairs before darkness came over her mind. And then pain, and more pain, and the room full of buzzing voices, and Aunt Pittypat's sobs, and Dr. Mead's brusque orders, and feet that hurried on the stairs and tiptoed in the upper hall. And then, like a blinding ray of lightning, the knowledge of death and fear that suddenly made her try to scream a name, and the scream was only a whisper. But that forlorn whisper brought instant response from somewhere in the darkness beside the bed, and the soft voice of the one she called made answer in lullaby tones. "I'm here, dear. I've been right here all the time." Death and fear receded gently as Melanie took her hand and laid it quietly against her cool cheek. Scarlett tried to turn to see her face and could not. Melly was having a baby, and the Yankees were coming. The town was afire, and she must hurry, hurry. But Melly was having a baby, and she couldn't hurry. She must stay with her till the baby came and be strong, because Melly needed her strength. Melly was hurting so bad. There were hot pinchers at her, and dull knives, and recurrent waves of pain. She must hold Melly's hand. But Dr. Mead was there after all. He had come even if the soldiers at the depot did need him, for she heard him say, "Delirious. Where's Captain Butler?" The night was dark, and then light, and sometimes she was having a baby, and sometimes it was Melanie who cried out. But through it all, Melly was there, and her hands were cool, and she didn't make futile, anxious gestures, a sob like Aunt Pity. Whenever Scarlett opened her eyes, she said, "Melly?" And the voice answered. And usually she started to whisper, "Rhett, I want Rhett." And remembered, as from a dream, that Rhett didn't want her. That Rhett's face was dark as an Indian's and his teeth were white in a jeer. She wanted him, and he didn't want her. Once she said, "Melly?" And Mammy's voice said, "Smee, child," and put a cold rag on her forehead, and she cried fretfully, "Melly, Melanie," over and over. But for a long time, Melanie did not come. For Melanie was sitting on the edge of Rhett's bed, and Rhett, drunk and sobbing, was sprawled on the floor crying, his head in her lap. Every time she had come out of Scarlett's room, she had seen him sitting on his bed, his door wide, watching the door across the hall. The room was untidy, littered with cigar butts and dishes of untouched food. The bed was tumbled and unmade, and he sat on it, unshaven and suddenly gaunt, endlessly smoking. He never asked questions when he saw her. She always stood in the doorway for a minute, giving the news. "I'm sorry. She's worse." Or, "No, she hasn't asked for you yet. You see, she's delirious." Or, "You mustn't give up hope, Captain Butler.
Let me fix you some hot coffee and something to eat. You'll make yourself ill. Her heart always ached with pity for him, although she was almost too tired and sleepy to feel anything. How could people say such mean things about him? Say he was heartless and wicked and unfaithful to Scarlet, when she could see him getting thin before her eyes, see the torment in his face. Tired as she was, she always tried to be kinder than usual when she gave bulletins from the sick room. He looked so like a damned soul waiting judgment. So like a child in a suddenly hostile world. But everyone was like a child to Melanie. But when, at last, she went joyfully to his door to tell him that Scarlet was better, she was unprepared for what she found. There was a half-empty bottle of whiskey on the table by the bed, and the room reeked with the odor. He looked up at her with bright, glazed eyes, and his jaw muscles trembled despite his efforts to set his teeth. "She's dead."
"Oh, no. She's much better," he said.
"Oh, my God," and put his head in his hands. She saw his wide shoulders shake as with a nervous chill, and as she watched him pityingly, her pity changed to horror, for she saw that he was crying. Melanie had never seen a man cry, and of all men, Rhett. So suave, so mocking, so eternally sure of himself. It frightened her, the desperate choking sound he made. She had a terrified thought that he was drunk, and Melanie was afraid of drunkenness. But when he raised his head, and she caught one glimpse of his eyes, she stepped swiftly into the room, closed the door softly behind her, and went to him. She had never seen a man cry, but she had comforted the tears of many children. When she put a soft hand on his shoulder, his arms went suddenly around her skirts. Before she knew how it happened, she was sitting on the bed and he was on the floor, his head in her lap, and his arms and hands clutching her in a frantic clasp that hurt her. She stroked the black head gently and said, "There, there," soothingly. "There. She's going to get well." At her words, his grip tightened, and he began speaking rapidly, hoarsely, babbling as though to a grave which would never give up its secrets, babbling the truth for the first time in his life, bearing himself mercilessly to Melanie, who was at first utterly uncomprehending, utterly maternal. He talked brokenly, burrowing his head in her lap, tugging at the folds of her skirt. Sometimes his words were blurred, muffled. Sometimes they came far too clearly to her ears, harsh, bitter words of confession and abasement. Speaking of things she had never heard even a woman mention. Secret things that brought the hot blood of modesty to her cheeks and made her grateful for his bowed head. She patted his head as she did little Beau's and said, "Hush, Captain Butler, you must not tell me these things. You're not yourself. Hush!" But his voice went on in a wild torrent of outpouring, and he held to her dress as though it were his hope of life. He accused himself of deeds she didn't understand. He mumbled the name of Belle Watling, and then he shook her with his violence as he cried, "I've killed Scarlet. I've killed her. You don't understand. She didn't want this baby."
"You must hush. You are beside yourself. Not want a baby. What every woman wants..."
"No, no, you want babies. She doesn't. Not my babies."
"You must stop.
You don't understand. She didn't want a baby and I made her. This baby, it's all my damn fault. We hadn't been sleeping together."
"Hush, Captain Butler, it's not fit."
"And I was drunk and insane and I wanted to hurt her. Because she had hurt me. I wanted to, and I did. But she didn't want me. She's never wanted me.
She never has, and I tried. I tried so hard, and...
Oh, please.
And I didn't know about this baby till the other day, when she fell. She didn't know where I was to write to me and tell me, but she wouldn't have written me if she had known. I tell you, I'd have come straight home, if I'd only known, whether she wanted me home or not.
Oh, yes, I know you would.
God, I've been crazy these weeks, crazy and drunk. And when she told me there on the steps, what did I do? What did I say?
I laughed and said, cheer up, maybe you'll have a miscarriage. And she... Melanie suddenly went white, and her eyes widened with horror as she looked down at the black, tormented head writhing in her lap. The afternoon sun streamed in through the open window, and suddenly she saw, as for the first time, how large and brown and strong his hands were, and how thickly the black hairs grew along the backs of them. Involuntarily she recoiled from them. They seemed so predatory, so ruthless, and yet twined in her skirt, so broken, so helpless. Could it be possible that he had heard and believed the preposterous lie about Scarlet and Ashley and become jealous? True, he had left town immediately after the scandal broke, but no, it couldn't be that. Captain Butler was always going off abruptly on journeys. He couldn't have believed the gossip. He was too sensible. If that had been the cause of the trouble, wouldn't he have tried to shoot Ashley? Or at least demanded an explanation? No, it couldn't be that. It was only that he was drunk and sick from strain, and his mind was running wild like a man delirious, babbling wild fantasies. Men couldn't stand strains as well as women. Something had upset him. Perhaps he had had a small quarrel with Scarlet and magnified it. Perhaps some of the awful things he had said were true. But all of them couldn't be true. Oh, not that last, certainly. No man could say such a thing to a woman he loved as passionately as this man loved Scarlet. Melanie had never seen evil, never seen cruelty. And now that she looked on them for the first time, she found them too inconceivable to believe. He was drunk and sick. And sick children must be humored. There. There, she said crooningly. Hush now. I understand. He raised his head violently and looked up at her with bloodshot eyes, fiercely throwing off her hands. No, by God, you don't understand. You can't understand. You're too good to understand. You don't believe me, but it's all true, and I'm a dog. Do you know why I did it? I was mad, crazy with jealousy. She never cared for me, and I thought I could make her care, but she never cared. She doesn't love me. She never has. She loves... His passionate, drunken gaze met hers, and he stopped. Mouth open, as though for the first time he realized to whom he was speaking. Her face was white and strained, but her eyes were steady and sweet, and full of pity and unbelief. There was a luminous serenity in them, and the innocence in the soft brown depth struck him like a blow in the face, clearing some of the alcohol out of his brain, halting his mad, careering words in mid-flight. He trailed off into a mumble, his eyes dropping away from hers, his lids batting rapidly as he fought back to sanity. "I'm a cad," he muttered, dropping his head tiredly back into her lap. "But not that big a cad. And if I did tell you, you wouldn't believe me, would you? You're too good to believe me. I never before knew anybody who was really good. You wouldn't believe me, would you?" "No, I wouldn't believe you," said Melanie soothingly, beginning to stroke his hair again. "She's going to get well. There, Captain Butler, don't cry. She's going to get well."
Chapter 57. It was a pale, thin woman that Rhett put on the Jonesboro train a month later. Wade and Ella, who were to make the trip with her, were silent and uneasy at their mother's still, white face. They clung close to Prissy, for even to their childish minds there was something frightening in the cold, impersonal atmosphere between their mother and their stepfather. Weak as she was, Scarlett was going home to Tara. She felt that she would stifle if she stayed in Atlanta another day, with her tired mind forcing itself round and round the deeply worn circle of futile thoughts about the mess she was in. She was sick in body and weary in mind, and she was standing like a lost child in a nightmare country in which there was no familiar landmark to guide her. As she had once fled Atlanta before an invading army, so she was fleeing it again, pressing her worries into the back of her mind with her old defense against the world.
"I won't think of it now. I can't stand it if I do. I'll think of it tomorrow at Tara. Tomorrow's another day."
It seemed that if she could only get back to the stillness and the green cotton fields of home, all her troubles would fall away and she would somehow be able to mold her shattered thoughts into something she could live by.
Rhett watched the train until it was out of sight, and on his face there was a look of speculative bitterness that was not pleasant. He sighed, dismissed the carriage and, mounting his horse, rode down Ivy Street toward Melanie's house. It was a warm morning, and Melanie sat on the vine-shaded porch, her mending basket piled high with socks. Confusion and dismay filled her when she saw Rhett alight from his horse and toss the reins over the arm of the cast-iron Negro boy who stood at the sidewalk. She hadn't seen him alone since that too dreadful day when Scarlett had been so ill and he had been so, well, so drunk. Melanie hated even to think the word. She had spoken to him only casually during Scarlett's convalescence, and on those occasions she had found it difficult to meet his eyes. However, he had been his usual bland self at those times, and never by look or word showed that such a scene had taken place between them. Ashley had told her once that men frequently didn't remember things said and done in drink, and Melanie prayed heartily that Captain Butler's memory had failed him on that occasion. She felt she would rather die than learn that he remembered his outpourings. Timidity and embarrassment swept over her, and waves of color mounted her cheeks as he came up the walk. But perhaps he had only come to ask if Beau could spend the day with Bonnie. Surely he wouldn't have the bad taste to come and thank her for what she had done that day. She rose to meet him, noting with surprise, as always, how lightly he walked for a big man. "Scarlett has gone?"
"Yes. Tara will do her good," he said, smiling. "Sometimes I think she's like the giant Antaeus who became stronger each time he touched Mother Earth. It doesn't do for Scarlett to stay away too long from that patch of red mud she loves. The sight of cotton growing will do her more good than all Dr. Mead's tonics."
"Won't you sit down?" said Melanie, her hands fluttering.
He was so very large and male, and excessively male creatures always discomposed her. They seemed to radiate a force and vitality that made her feel smaller and weaker even than she was. He looked so swarthy and formidable, and the heavy muscles in his shoulders swelled against his white linen coat in a way that frightened her. It seemed impossible that she had seen all this strength and insolence brought low. And she had held that black head in her lap. "Oh, dear," she thought in distress, and blushed again.
"Miss Melly," he said gently, "does my presence annoy you? Would you rather I went away? Pray be frank."
"Oh," she thought, "he does remember. And he knows how upset I am." She looked at him,
imploringly, and suddenly her embarrassment and confusion faded. His eyes were so quiet, so kind, so understanding that she wondered how she could ever have been silly enough to be flurried. His face looked tired, and she thought with surprise, more than a little sad. How could she have even thought he'd be ill-bred enough to bring up subjects both would rather forget? Poor thing. He's been so worried about Scarlet, she thought. And managing a smile, she said, Do sit down, Captain Butler.
He sat down heavily and watched her as she picked up her darning.
Miss Melly,
I've come to ask a very great favor of you, and... He smiled and his mouth twisted down. To enlist your aid in a deception from which I know you will shrink.
Deception?
Yes. Really, I've come to talk business to you.
Oh, dear. Then it's Mr. Wilkes you'd better see. I'm such a goose about business. I'm not smart like Scarlet.
I'm afraid Scarlet is too smart for her own good, he said. And that is exactly what I want to talk to you about. You know how ill she's been. When she gets back from Terra, she will start again hammer and tongs with the store and those mills, which I wish devoutly would explode some night. I fear for her health, Miss Melly.
Yes, she does far too much. You must make her stop and take care of herself.
He laughed. You know how headstrong she is. I never even try to argue with her. She's just like a willful child. She won't let me help her. She won't let anyone help her. I've tried to get her to sell her share in the mills, but she won't. And now, Miss Melly, I come to the business matter. I know Scarlet would sell the remainder of her interest in the mills to Mr. Wilkes, but to no one else. And I want Mr. Wilkes to buy her out.
Oh, dear me, that would be nice, but... Melanie stopped and bit her lip. She couldn't mention money matters to an outsider. Somehow, despite what he made from the mill, she and Ashley never seemed to have enough money. It worried her that they saved so little. She didn't know where the money went. Ashley gave her enough to run the house on, but when it came to extra expenses, they were often pinched. Of course, her doctor bills were so much, and then the books and furniture Ashley ordered from New York did run into money. And they had fed and clothed any number of waifs who slept in their cellar. And Ashley never felt like refusing a loan to any man who'd been in the Confederate Army. And,
Miss Melly, I want to lend you the money, said Rhett.
That's so kind of you. But we might never repay it.
I don't want it repaid.
Don't be angry with me, Miss Melly. Please hear me through.
It will repay me enough to know that Scarlet will not be exhausting herself driving miles to the mills every day. The store will be enough to keep her busy and happy. Don't you see?
Well, yes, said Melanie uncertainly.
You want your boy to have a pony, don't you? And want him to go to the university and to Harvard and to Europe on a grand tour?
Oh, of course, cried Melanie, her face lighting up, as always, at the mention of Beau. I want him to have everything, but, well... Everyone is so poor these days that
Mr. Wilkes could make a pile of money out of the mill some day, said Rhett. And I'd like to see Beau have all the advantages he deserves.
Oh, Captain Butler, what a crafty wretch you are, she cried, smiling, appealing to a mother's pride. I can read you like a book.
I hope not, said Rhett. And for the first time there was a gleam in his eye. Now will you let me lend you the money?
But where does the deception come in?
We must be conspirators and deceive both Scarlet and Mr. Wilkes.
Oh, dear, I couldn't.
If Scarlet knew I had plotted behind her back, even for her own good, well,
You know her temper. And I'm afraid Mr. Wilkes would refuse any loan I offered him. So neither of them must know where the money comes from.
Oh, but I'm sure Mr. Wilkes wouldn't refuse if he understood the matter. He's so fond of Scarlett.
Yes, I'm sure he is, said Brett smoothly. But just the same, he would refuse. You know how proud all the Wilkes are.
Oh, dear,
cried Melanie miserably.
I wish... Really, Captain Butler, I couldn't deceive my husband.
Not even to help Scarlett. Rhett looked very hurt. And she's so fond of you.
Tears trembled on Melanie's eyelids. You know I'd do anything in the world for her. I can never, never half repay her for what she's done for me. You know.
Yes, he said shortly. I know what she's done for you. Couldn't you tell Mr. Wilkes that the money was left you in the will of some relative?
Oh, Captain Butler, I haven't a relative with a penny to bless him.
Then if I sent the money through the mail to Mr. Wilkes without his knowing who sent it, would you see that it was used to buy the mills and not, well, given away to destitute ex-Confederates? At first she looked hurt at his last words, as though they implied criticism of Ashley, but he smiled so understandingly she smiled back.
Of course I will.
So it's settled? It's to be our secret?
But I have never kept anything secret from my husband.
I'm sure of that, Miss Melly.
As she looked at him, she thought how right she had always been about him, and how wrong so many other people were. People had said he was brutal and sneering and bad-mannered and even dishonest. Though many of the nicest people were now admitting they had been wrong. Well, she had known from the very beginning that he was a fine man. She had never received from him anything but the kindest treatment, thoughtfulness, utter respect. And what understanding! And then how he loved Scarlett. How sweet of him to take this roundabout way of sparing Scarlett one of the loads she carried. In an impulsive rush of feeling, she said, Scarlett's lucky to have a husband who's so nice to her.
You think so? I'm afraid she wouldn't agree with you if she could hear you. Besides, I want to be nice to you too, Miss Millie. I'm giving you more than I'm giving Scarlett.
Me? She questioned, puzzled. Oh, you mean for Beau? He picked up his hat and rose.
He stood for a moment looking down at the plain, heart-shaped face with its long widow's peak and serious dark eyes. Such an unworldly face. A face with no defenses against life. No, not Beau. I'm trying to give you something more than Beau. If you can imagine that.
No, I can't, she said, bewildered again. There's nothing in the world more precious to me than Beau except Mr. Wilkes.
Rhett said nothing and looked down at her, his dark face still.
You're mighty nice to want to do things for me, Captain Butler, but really, I'm so lucky. I have everything in the world any woman could want.
That's fine, said Rhett, suddenly grim. And I intend to see that you keep them.
When Scarlett came back from Terra, the unhealthy pallor had gone from her face and her cheeks were rounded and faintly pink. Her green eyes were alert and sparkling again, and she laughed aloud for the first time in weeks when Rhett and Bonnie met her and Wade and Ella at the depot. Laughed in annoyance and amusement. Rhett had two straggling turkey feathers in the brim of his hat, and Bonnie, dressed in a sadly torn dress that was her Sunday frock, had diagonal lines of indigo blue on her cheeks and a peacock feather half as long as she was in her curls. Evidently a game of Indian had been in progress when the time came to meet the train. and it was obvious from the look of quizzical helplessness on Rhett's face and the lowering indignation of Mammy that Bonnie had refused to have her toilet remedied, even to meet her mother. Scarlett said, "What a ragamuffin!" as she kissed the child and turned a cheek for Rhett's lips. There were crowds of people in the depot, or she would never have invited this caress. She couldn't help noticing, for all her embarrassment at Bonnie's appearance, that everyone in the crowd was smiling at the figure father and daughter cut, smiling not in derision, but in genuine amusement and kindness. Everyone knew that Scarlett's youngest had her father under her thumb, and Atlanta was amused and approving. Rhett's great love for his child had gone far toward reinstating him in public opinion. On the way home, Scarlett was full of county news. The hot, dry weather was making the cotton grow so fast you could almost hear it, but Will said cotton prices were going to be low this fall. Sue Ellen was going to have another baby. She spelled this out so the children would not comprehend. And Ellen had shown unwonted spirit in biting Sue Ellen's oldest girl. Though, observed Scarlett, it was no more than little Susie deserved, she being her mother all over again. But Sue Ellen had become infuriated, and they had had an invigorating quarrel that was just like old times. Wade had killed a water moccasin all by himself. Randa and Camilla Tarleton were teaching school, and wasn't that a joke? Not a one of the Tarletons had ever been able to spell cat. Betsy Tarleton had married a fat, one-armed man from Lovejoy, and they and Hetty and Jim Tarleton were raising a good cotton crop at Fairhill. Mrs. Tarleton had a brood mare and a colt and was as happy as though she had $1 million. And there were Negroes living in the old Calvert house. Swarms of them, and they actually owned it. They'd bought it at the sheriff's sale. The place was dilapidated, and it made you cry to look at it. No one knew where Kathleen and her no-good husband had gone, and Alex was to marry Sally, his brother's widow. Imagine that, after them living in the same house for so many years. Everybody said it was a marriage of convenience because people were beginning to gossip about them living there alone, since both old Miss and young Miss had died. And it had about broken Dimity Monroe's heart. But it served her right. If she'd had any gumption, she'd have caught her another man long ago, instead of waiting for Alex to get money enough to marry her. Scarlett chattered on cheerfully, but there were many things about the county which she suppressed. Things that hurt to think about. She had driven over the county with Will, trying not to remember when these thousands of fertile acres had stood green with cotton. Now, plantation after plantation was going back to the forest, and dismal fields of broom sedge, scrub oak, and runty pines had grown stealthily about silent ruins and over old cotton fields. Only 1 acre was being farmed now, where once 100 had been under the plow. It was like moving through a dead land. "This section won't come back for 50 years, if it ever comes back," Will had said. "Tara's the best farm in the county, thanks to you and me, Scarlett. But it's a farm, a 2-mule farm, not a plantation. And the Fontaine place, it comes next to Tara and then the Tarletons. They ain't making much money, but they're getting along and they got gumption. But most of the rest of the folks, the rest of the farms..." No. Scarlett did not like to remember the way the deserted county looked. It seemed even sadder in retrospect, beside the bustle and prosperity of Atlanta. "Has anything happened here?" she asked, when they were finally home and were seated on the front porch. She had talked rapidly and continuously all the way home, fearing that a silence would fall. She had not had a word alone with Rhett since that day when she fell down the steps, and she was none too anxious to be alone with him now. She didn't know how he felt toward her. He had been kindness itself during her miserable convalescence. But it was the kindness of an impersonal stranger. He had anticipated her wants, kept the children from bothering her, and supervised the store and the mills. But he had never said, "I'm sorry." Well, perhaps he wasn't sorry. Perhaps he still thought that child that was never born wasn't his child. How could she tell what went on in the mind behind the bland, dark face? But he had showed a disposition to be courteous for the first time in their married life, and a desire to let life go on as though there had never been anything unpleasant between them. As though, thought Scarlet, cheerlessly, as though there had never been anything at all between them. Well, if that was what he wanted, she could act her part, too. "Is everything all right?" she repeated. "Did you get the new shingles for the store? Did you swap the mules? For heaven's sake, Rhett, take those feathers out of your hat. You look a fool, and you'll be likely to wear them downtown without remembering to take them out." "No," said Bonnie, picking up her father's hat defensively.
"Everything has gone very well here," replied Rhett. "Bonnie and I have had a nice time, and I don't believe her hair has been combed since you left. Don't suck the feathers, darling. They may be nasty. Yes, the shingles are fixed, and I got a good trade on the mules. No, there's really no news. Everything has been quite dull."
Then, as an afterthought, he added,
"The Honorable Ashley was over here last night. He wanted to know if I thought you would sell him your mill and the part interest you have in his."
Scarlet, who had been rocking and fanning herself with a turkey tail feather,